Hello and welcome to the, let's see here. What are we on? What are we on, John? Like number 35? 35. Episode 35 of the Functional Nerds. My name's Patrick Hester, and I'm an author, a blogger, and an all-around functional nerd. And my partner in crime on this little adventure is Mr. John Anilio. Say hello, John.
Hey, I'm John Anilio. I write songs about science fiction and fantasy. You can get a lot of my music for as little as free over at johnanilio.blogspot. No, I'm so saying the address wrong. johnanilio.bandcamp.com. And yeah, go to Bandcamp and I don't know, just put my name in Google. You can find all my stuff. I do.
And they say I'm bad. I even wrote down the damn episode number here on my notepad and I still didn't even look at it. And then you screw up your website. That's hilarious.
Yeah. I own johnanilio.com and I really have to start doing something with that. I was going to talk to you about that because I might want you to help me out with doing something with johnanilio.com so I don't have to like remember all this other stuff. But anyway, I also do a video blog for Wired, Geek Dad Guitar Lessons. You can check that out. Anyway, so thanks for joining us this week. This is another one.
I was just going to say, this is after Thanksgiving, right?
Yes, this will be post Thanksgiving, and this is going to so happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
Yes,
a week later, and this is going to be another World Fantasy Convention episode, as we said last time. And if you listen to last week's episode with Lucy A. Snyder, I also recorded two other interviews, and we're going to run another one this week. And this week's interview is with two former guests of the show. Blake Charlton and James Eng, both are fantasy novelists. And Blake was one of our first like big author guests. And for those of you who
he's not that big. I can take him.
I think he's a sizable dude. But anyway, he, as most people know who live the show, Blake is a fantasy a novelist, but he's also a med student and he's also dyslexic. And we talked a lot about that when we had him on the show and about how the human brain works.
And bald.
Yes. And with just nothing to do with the dyslexia, I don't think. Anyway, when we had James Eng on a few months later, James, in addition to being a novelist, is also a professor of Latin. And when Blake was on the show, he had talked about how dyslexia is less common in certain languages and how he, as a med student, didn't have too hard of a time with Latin and Greek because they're pretty phonetic. They, you know, words are spelled the way they sound. And so when we had James on the show, I thought we have to get these two guys in a room together. And then when Patrick and I decided to go to World Fantasy, when looking at the list, we saw that Blake and James were both going to be there. So I immediately emailed them both and asked if they wanted to be interviewed together and to talk about Latin and dyslexia and languages and in novels and things. And we did, and came out great, I think. And I think you're really going to enjoy this interview.
You know what's weird, though?
What's that?
V's in Latin are pronounced like W's.
V's?
Yes. So it'd be instead of veni vici, it'd be veni vici.
It would be spelt with a W?
Spelled with a V, pronounced with a W.
Oh, that's weird.
And another interesting thing, if you walk up to James Eng and you say, hey, Wenny Weedy Weechy, he'll just look at you strange and walk away.
I see. I did not say that to him when he walked up to me, though, so yeah. It was fine. But
this is another interview that I'm not a part of. And in this case, I was going to be, but Blake Charlton told me, you know, to frack off. And so I left. It really hurt my feelings.
Blake Charlton did not tell Patrick to frack off. Like, Charlton is an extremely nice dude who doesn't generally tell people to frack off, at least not to their face, at least anyway. But anyway, I hope everyone enjoys this interview. I think it's really interesting stuff is covered here, so I think you'll dig it.
We love you, Blake.
All right, this is John Anilio. I'm at World Fantasy, and we're sitting with Blake Charlton and James Eng, both who were previous guests on the show. Blake Charlton is the author of Spellwright and the upcoming, what's the second book called?
Spellbound.
Spellbound, and James Eng is the author of Blood of Ambrose, and is it This Crooked Way or The...
This Crooked Way, and also, it should be out by the time you guys hear this, The Wolf Age is my third book.
Okay, great, good. And we can maybe chat a little bit about those books later, but the reason I wanted to get James and Blake together on the show was because
And Blake can maybe go into this a little more. I found out about Blake because I heard him on the Geek's Guide to the Galaxy podcast, and he was talking about his experience as a dyslexic growing up and overcoming that. And he talked quite a bit about, and you can maybe speak to this a little more. Why don't you speak to this now about how in certain languages there's a disproportionate amount of dyslexia as opposed to English and some other languages. Why don't you talk about that?
So dyslexia is a condition that happens, is actually dependent on which language you speak, and very few people with a condition even realize this. But dyslexia at its clinical basis is an inability to deal with the way in which sounds are encoded. And there are certain languages, because of their history, that have especially tricky orthographies. So English, we have, I believe it's 34 sounds that we make, and as for all the words we make in English, and we have several hundreds, and by some estimates, thousands of ways of encoding for those sounds. You might consider the phoneme F, which can be made with an F, can be made with a PH, can be made with an O-U-G-H. And it's because we're speaking an essentially Germanic language that then had Latin imposed upon it. And it's very difficult to be dyslexic. There are fewer dyslexics in languages that have the original rules attached to them. So Italian, there are one-third as many per capita dyslexics in Italian-speaking populations as there are in English or French. Speaking populations in languages that use other alphabets, such as Chinese, you actually can't have what we call dyslexia. It's more of a visual processing disorder that you can't have, that we actually can't have. And the when I was in high school, the way to get around that, I grew up in California, so I was warned against, as a dyslexic, not taking Spanish, because, you know, we all spoke enough Spanish, and the native speakers were going to far outstrip me. French is just out. And so the language I started taking was Latin, and I found that I'm not disabled in Latin. Spelling in Latin is very straightforward, and you can, if it makes that sound, you write, you know, I don't know how many phonemes there are in Latin and how many ways there are to encode for it.
Well, I never thought to count, although I did have a linguistics undergraduate major, because I knew you could make any money in Latin. But after a while, I decided I didn't care if I made any money or not. But I forget how many phonemes there are in Latin. But they certainly have less. They have less allophones, which are the variants in certain phonological contexts. So. Right. An S between vowels would never become a Z, like S in English.
Right.
So I think phonologically it's probably similar.
And we should back up for a second. One of the reasons why I wanted to get James and Blake together is because James, now you, what is you teach at the university level, and so what are the subjects that you do teach? I know.
I teach Latin, sometimes Greek, although my partner in crime up there does most of the Greek teaching. But I sneak in one every once in a while. Mostly I teach Latin, and in English translation I teach myth and Roman civilization.
Great, great. And one thing Blake just pointed out with some of the Asian languages, I met, this is like 10 years ago, and I was talking to a guy, he's from Taiwan, and he was explaining how in their language there aren't as many sounds, but they actually have to pitch their language. It's almost like they're singing a little bit.
It's tonal.
Tonal languages are really interesting, and that you can, the same phonemes pitched at different tones mean are actual whole different words. Mm-hmm. I don't speak any, nor have I studied any tonal language, so I can't speak to it too much, but in the neurological literature, there was a really interesting study of a correlation between what language was first learned and the correlation of perfect pitch in that population. Mm-hmm. So if you grew up speaking a tonal language, I'm forgetting the exact number, but it's shocking. There are, I think, 70% of people who grow up speaking a tonal language have perfect pitch, whereas those of us who speak non-tonal languages, most European languages are non-tonal, it's something like 5 10.
If that. I was a music major in college, so these are people that are inclined to do this. I maybe knew 2 or 3 people that had a perfect pitch in the music department at a university. Yeah. It's very rare, at least in our culture, for that to develop, because perfect pitch, some people feel it's just you're either born with that or you're not. But kind of to speak to what you're saying, there are people that can develop it.
Yeah.
Now most musicians, if you go through a university level course, you will develop what's called relative pitch. And I have relative pitch. Relative pitch is essentially, if I'm given a starting note, I can then sing and hear all of the various intervals from that starting note. And I could probably guess certain pitches, but not with any accuracy. If you said, hum a B flat, I probably couldn't do it right now. But that's very interesting about some of the Asian languages with that. And the other thing, too, he was telling me, this is kind of a little interesting thing about that is, I guess it would be Taiwanese. I guess that's the language that he spoke. But the sound that you made, it was just a different pitch, but the sound for the number four and for the word death.
Yeah, that's very common, the number four. I think that's in many.
So the number four is an unlucky number because it's the same sound as. But when you speak it, you speak it with a different tone. So that's how you can differentiate the
two. A little difference would make a big slippage in meaning.
Yes.
So you need that sense of pitch. Otherwise, you can't order a cup of coffee or fish or something.
Yeah. Now, I wonder what, you know, sort of the cultural basis for the language is developing. I mean, obviously, it's, you know, it's not like the world today where we're basically one big world. So everybody is, you know, talking to each other. So, but when you think about the fact that, you know, the European cultures and the Asian cultures did not even know that they existed, that each other existed for however many thousands of years, everything just developed so, so differently. So it's interesting when these kind of cultures sort of clash together. Now, in terms of English and Italian and Latin, what do you think the reasoning, and obviously Latin is the base of Italian and Spanish, but I mean, would Latin be the base for French as well?
Yeah, the writing system's gone a lot further. It's not at all phonetic, which is why dyslexia must be high there too. But it's still a Romance language.
Okay.
One could argue, and some people have argued, that English is a Romance language now. Because of the Norman conquest, there's so many French words in English. But the grammar is still Germanic. Mm-hmm. What grammar is left?
And the other interesting thing about English spelling is some languages take in new words, and other languages refuse to take in new words and want to invent their own versions by piling them together. English is kind of a slut. It will take in anything that comes near it. So we have the word ketchup comes from Southern Chinese. The word pajama comes from Hindi. Mm-hmm. My language is Hindi. And, you know, all over the world, caucus, I think, came from an Iroquois language. And many languages don't do that. But so when English does this, it also incorporates the spelling of the original parent language. That's why when you watch these documentaries about a spelling bee, the contestant will say, what is the origin of the word? And they will say, oh, it's Greek, or oh, it's Italian, or oh, it's Chinese. And that will give them a clue about what set of rules you need to follow.
Mm-hmm. Although, yeah, there's even sets of rules, because if the alphabet or whatever the writing system is different, there are going to be multiple different ways mm-hmm. to encode it. So that's why Peking became Beijing.
Right.
There are all these different ways to encode the same word in a different language.
But for example, if you go to Italy, you cannot find a spelling bee. There aren't any. Or in Germany, there's no point to having a spelling bee if everybody can spell.
If you can say it, you can spell.
Spell, exactly.
Interesting. You know, and I teach music, and a lot of what sort of an elementary school curriculum teaches is folk music from lots of different cultures, not just from America. And one of the things that I always talk about, if there's translation, so we'll have whatever the original language is and an English translation. And translating songs is always a difficult business because you have to kind of make it fit into the original meter of the tune. And one of the things I always try to get the kids that I teach to understand about the original language and the original song and the intent is that comparatively, English is I always ask them this question. If it's a song that's in Spanish, let's say, or a song that's in Italian, and I'll play them both. I'll play them the Spanish version and then the English version, and I'll ask them, which version do you think sounds better? And I'm like, I know you don't understand this, and I know it's going to sound funny to you, but what sounds more pleasing to the ear? And I try to get them to understand that, you know, 9 times out of 10, it's always going to sound better in its original language. But a language like Spanish or Italian or Latin is such a much better language to sing in because many of those words end in vowels. And when you're saying a vowel, your mouth is open.
Yeah.
That's much easier to hold out a pitch when you're your mouth is open. And in English, half the time, you're ending on a consonant where your mouth is closed and you're trying to sort of have your words go out that way.
Vowels are impure in English, too. They're very often diphthongized. Uh-huh. So we don't say "o" in English. We say "oh." You know, we don't say "a." We say "a." So there's almost always a glide at the end of our long vowels. That's why lots of singers study Italian, not for the opera or anything like that, just to get that pure vowels practice and saying the vowel without the diphthong or the glide at the end.
Interesting.
Yeah, and it's funny too, because if you I knew a lot of voice majors when I was in college, and my wife was a voice major as well, and because you're sort of gearing towards singing opera. And so much opera, while a lot of it is Italian, which is great to sing in, a lot is in German.
Oh yeah,
which is probably the is probably the hardest language to sing in. Everything is so consonant and rough sounding. But that's what of the era when opera was really doing its most stuff. It was Germanic composers, and that's was kind of what it was.
Yeah, although the composer and the librettist are often different.
Yes.
What's his face? De Ponte, was it? Worked with Mozart a lot.
Yeah, I'm not even sure. And some of Mozart's, I'm trying to think if all of his stuff was in Austrian or not. But anyway, yeah, you're right. It's funny how the language develops in that way. And
Magic Flute, that's one that's in German.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's when we think of when I teach music history, you are talking about a pretty, relatively speaking, a pretty brief history in time in terms of when music started being written. You know, because obviously music existed for, millennia before it started getting written down. And you have, like, in your Renaissance era when it starts getting real basic notation. But in sort of what would be considered the Baroque period, which is Bach, and that's, we're talking like 1600s through today, but mostly, we can even cut it off at like the late 1800s. You know, it's like a 300-year period. And all of this was taking place in a fairly small bit of Europe. You're talking sort of Italy through all the, the German, Austria, all that kind of stuff. And so in music, it's kind of funny what you were saying, how English will sort of take the words and just sort of keep them in the original language. You know, musically speaking, lots of the terminology we use is, some of it's German, but a lot of it is Italian. So, your dynamic
pianoforte.
One. Pianoforte. Yeah, pianoforte. When I love explaining that to a kid, why a piano is called a piano, is because before, keyboard instruments prior to the piano were like the harpsichord and the clavichord. And the limit of those instruments was that if you press down, real softly on a harpsichord, it still played sort of a medium dynamic. And if you bashed it, it still played kind of a medium dynamic, because you press down the key and it would sort of pull the string. Whereas when the piano was developed, it was a gigantic technological innovation, because if you press softly, it played softly. If you banged it, it was really loud. And that was a huge thing for musical expressiveness. And so when it was invented, it was called the forte piano, which meant the loud soft. You could play loud, you could play soft, which, when we think about it, it's such a ridiculous name for an instrument. And then it just was eventually just shortened to the piano. So I tell you guys, I'm like, that's the soft. That's what we're calling this instrument, which is so funny. But I love telling them, teaching them a little bit about the Italian words. And so all your dynamics and all your tempo, your andante, your all that. But I'm always really just fascinated with language. And I think a lot of it happened from, like, watching those spelling bees, just thinking about how, boy, it's just, there's so much out there. And if you really understand them, which is why I think they tell you, the advice that they give teenagers is, study Latin, because if you study Latin, that's the root of so many words, and you can figure out what words mean. Not all the time, but I think it's a good base to have, for sure.
When I took the graduate records exam, the GRE, to get into grad school, the verbal section was easy, because even if I didn't know the word, I knew the roots, and I divided and conquered. And I worked like crazy on the math section. If I just got like 30 seconds more per question on the math section, I could have done much, much better. So I worked and I worked and I worked and I worked. Did practice test after practice test. Didn't change my score at all. And when I handed in my GREs to my my grad schools, they said, "Oh, we never looked at the math. We just looked at the verbal." I wish I knew a trick for math the way Latin works for the verbal section. There's no question. So much learned vocabulary is ripped off from Latin or Greek.
So I have a question for you, James, as a classics professor writing fantasy. How, and I'm sure other people must feel pretty strongly about how that's influenced your writing. How do you perceive that as influenced your writing?
Well, I do what I would do anyway, which is steal from the myths. So there's a sort of running gag in the Morlock books that only I know about, where Morlock steals a bit of Hercules' biography.
Huh.
So, for instance, in the second book, he's attacked by this huge stone monster that's somewhat lion-like, and he can't penetrate it with any of his weapons. So he takes a big club, he tears it off a tree, and he batters it. And that's right out of Hercules' first labor.
Sure.
You don't have to know anything about Hercules to get that. But if you know the myth, then it adds a little sort of ironic flavor to it.
Well, and that's really interesting because I feel, and this is just shooting from the hip, there I have no statistical data to back this up, but much of fantasy today seems inspired by Germanic myth and Norse myth, and Latin myth and classical myth seems somewhat underrepresented. Would you agree with that?
It might be true. It may be because it was overrepresented before. Or I love the Germanic myth too. I took Old English and Old Norse, and I love those languages too. The gods are more interesting, I think. This may be blasphemy as a classicist. In Norse myth, the gods can suffer, the gods can die. In fact, the gods are doomed. So there's much more dramatic excitement in the gods in Norse mythology, and that appeals to people strongly. The dramatic tension in the classical world is with the heroes.
Huh.
So if you don't know the heroes, you just know the gods, you'll probably prefer Norse mythology.
Interesting. And is that because the heroes are mortal and that lends a little more tension?
They're doomed. They have to make choices. The great choice of Achilles, right, is whether he's going to live a long, dull life wearing leather patches, teaching classics somewhere, or whether he's going to live a short, glorious life as a sword and sorcery author.
Kleos, yeah.
And of course he chooses Kleos, but not before he thinks about it and almost chooses the other way. So that's what the whole drama of the Iliad is about, is his choice. So, on the other hand, if somebody makes you read the Iliad, I don't think you enjoy it. I don't think literature should be required. I think it should be forbidden. They should ban books. They'd become much more exciting.
I didn't read for pleasure until I was done with college. I never, and you know, in high school, I never read anything other than what, you know, was assigned, and I was always a good student, so I always did well. But I didn't grow up in a house where my parents really read for pleasure. And I think if you do, that sort of sets you on that path of wanting to just read. But to me, reading was homework.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
In my time, why was I going to do homework when I had plenty of homework to do already?
Yeah.
And I wish, like, I think that's a good way to put it, is I wish at least they would give you some more, although I think this is changing in education anyway, a little more choice of what to read, you know, a little more just freedom, because I think if it's just, you know, you go to a bookstore in August, you're going to see the same, you know,
classroom
15,
classics.
20 books that I read 20 years ago almost in high school. And it's like, well, can't we open this up a little bit? Can't we just, you know, have, you know, especially now, because maybe just because I'm a little more aware of it these days, but there really seems to be, probably post all the Harry Potter stuff,
right,
there seems to be a lot of young adult books out there that are, you know, really well done and really appealing to, you know, that age and older even. And why not, you know, allow that? I mean, that it sort of sets you on the path of wanting to continue to read rather than reading, you know, just, you know, Animal Farm or any of that kind of stuff that everybody had to read.
One of the reasons why Harry Potter is so big is because it was a scholastic book in the United States, and kids could order it. They did order it. They liked it.
Mm.
You can teach from Harry Potter. I don't think she's the greatest writer in the world, but she is one of the great storytellers, obviously. I mean, you don't do what she did without having talent.
Absolutely.
And like I said, on a sentence-by-sentence level, my daughter, who's a big fan of the book, she reads them and she's disgusted. But she can't stop reading them because they're such good stories. And everybody's looking for the next Harry Potter, but I mean, I think one thing that schools should do is try and direct more books towards boys. I don't mean to sound like, you know, it's like I'm grinding an axe for my gender, but I know that my son would not read now at all if all he had to read was the stuff they gave him in school. He loves reading because he's reading my Asimov Heinlein paperbacks, you know, the stuff I had from when I was his age.
Like, did you have a post about that?
Yeah, one of the most popular posts I ever wrote was a post called "Books Are for Girls?" with a question mark. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of, you know, Spellwright is, if you want to get into the publishing minutia, it's called YA okay, hard epic fantasy.
Right.
And so it's meant to appeal mostly to, you know, when I sat down and wrote it, I was writing about my experiences in special ed as a young man, and I was thinking many of my readers would be young people, also, you know, perhaps not in special ed, but in similar situations, and I don't know too many 15-year-olds or 18-year-olds who don't feel put in a corner in some way. And so that's what I was writing for, and surprise, surprise, I go to events, and I'm always thrilled when people are there. They're usually over 40. When younger people do show up, they're predominantly female. So that led to this post, and I went around on the internet and looked up a lot of things, and it seemed the knee-jerk reaction was to blame video games, to say young men are out there playing World of Warcraft and they're violent and they're doing all these awful things, and that's why it's video games' fault they're not reading. And my point to this post was, well, maybe not. You know, when I am not, the fact that I had to write something called YA okay, meaning they put it in adult science fiction fantasy, because the YA section is, I think, biased more towards girls these days. And I think that's market driven. I don't think that's demand driven. I think Twilight, I haven't read it. I hear it does some things amazingly well, but I think it's created kind of a market frenzy. Mm-hmm. So when you just look at the young adult section, it predominantly looks like young adults do, you know, young women specifically, whereas the young men, it's thought, need to, like, walk over, and I don't agree with that. And the whole point of the post was, you know, the market made it so doesn't necessarily mean it has to be this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would agree with that. I think it is that I'll often see in the school that I teach in, and it goes up till 10 years old, and you know, I see a lot of boys that will read, you know, that will read for pleasure, and I think there's you know, in addition to their just normal language arts class, I think they have at the beginning of each day, I think they have like sort of a 10-minute read whatever you want kind of a thing, and I think that's really important. And I'll see you know, boys at, you know, dismissal time sitting there thumbing through, whether it's even like a little you know, like one of the Star Wars books or something like that. I mean, anything. Why not just get them in the habit? I think
Why does it have to be stuff with vitamins? I mean,
exactly.
It's a skill that you need to practice, and not everything. It's like saying you have to exercise, but you can't play a game that'll be fun.
Right.
You have to do something which is serious. Serious exercise is what we're all about here. Mm-hmm. It's like, that's ridiculous. Nobody teaches physical education that way. Why do we teach literary education?
Yeah, that's very good. One of the ideas we're talking about here is the idea of a canon of literature.
Yeah.
And if you base your education off of a canon of certain books, you're not teaching strictly reading or writing or composition. You're actually teaching culture. You said, okay, we've distilled American culture down to The Scarlet Letter and The Great Gatsby and The Grapes of Wrath. And those are all wonderful books, and I love them. But when you teach those books, you're not just saying, hey, reading is interesting and fun, can take you places in the world. You're saying, this is American literature, right? And you need to come out of here with some idea of American literature. And you can't, and like, I think we overplay that idea, but I don't think you can throw it away totally. Mm-hmm. You know, you do have to, at some level, and I agree completely with you, James, that especially when you're young, reading should be more fun than anything else. At some level, you do want some idea of what American literature is, what world literature is, what post-colonial literature is. These are all interesting topics, but you can't make it hard work.
Yeah.
You can't make it off-putting.
If they're used to it, if they've developed some of the muscles to continue that metaphor, they can bench press Grapes of Wrath.
You know? Exactly.
They're ready for the harder stuff because they've worked their way into it. It's not a form of suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, one of the a kid that I saw last year in the school that I teach, and he was carrying around a book with him, and I asked because it looked sort of like a fantasy book, but I never heard of it. It was obviously geared towards his age, and I said, like, what's that? And he's like, oh, it's you know, he was explaining it to me. He's like, it's kind of like this video game that I play, so I really like it. So it's like, what's wrong with that? Like, yeah, it's exactly. Obviously if it goes through. If it's published,
yeah.
It goes through so many rewrites and editing. It's going to be a well-written enough book to get published. So this kid likes video games like every 10-year-old boy does.
Exactly.
But he's reading. And so, you know, he's going to be... He's your audience. He's James Ang and Blake Charlton's audience 5 years from now, you know?
Hopefully.
Yeah, I mean, that's so to me, it's like... And if you look at... You mentioned something like World of Warcraft or any of the video... I don't really play video games at all anymore, but when, you know, from what I can tell, it's fantasy. Like, a lot of it is fantasy that they're just playing. So it's like, do you realize, like, you can read this and it's even... It's deeper. I think when I got into reading more for pleasure when I was in my 20s, it was work for me at first, but I don't know if I, in my early 20s, I just felt like I want to feel smarter or something. I just really made it a point. It's like, I want to sit and read. Like, I want to really get through this. Because I guess in you know, when I had done that when I was younger, you do have a sense of accomplishment, at least, when you get through a book. Even if it's like, you know, a 300-page book or something. And then, like you said, it's building the muscle. So now I read much faster and all that, but I enjoy it. And it's a much more reading... It's a much more enriching experience. It's a much... you're sort of... It's almost like a podcast. We talk about this with podcast versus a blog. Now, you can get a ton of hits on your blog, especially if you do, like, a top 10 post or a 7 Reasons Why post.
Right, sure.
Because it's, you know, it's, people can sort of ingest that really quickly. And you could say, like, I have X number of hits or whatever. Now, with podcasts, I feel like it's because you have people in your ear. Mm-hmm. You're experiencing them on a much deeper level. Mm-hmm. You know, so, you know, you guys can both write blog posts and reach probably way more people than you would in talking on a podcast. But I heard Blake on a podcast first. Now, I immediately had a connection to what he was talking about with dyslexia and everything. So right there, I don't know if you just wrote a post on the same thing, I might have come across and be like, oh, that's interesting. And then, but that's it. So I think a novel is, you know, a way of just really just getting sort of thrust into that author's mind, into that world. And it's such a much deeper experience than just playing a video game or watching a movie or what have you. And I think, you know, I don't know how that can be communicated to people who aren't in the habit of reading, other than just what people are doing already and just trying to, you know, as you said, you know, market more. And maybe, you know, maybe there's, especially with the boys, you know, making that link. But it's hard not to be pandering about it, too. It's like, if you like video games, you're going to like this. You know, so you have to kind of do it in a subtle way, and I don't think it's an easy answer. You know?
Nothing is grosser than a grown-up trying to be cool with younger kids. It's better to avoid that entirely. But on the other hand, you want to offer stuff that they'll like. And they want you to, I think. I mean, certainly my kids did. They wanted to know what their options were. Mm-hmm.
So. Well, and to go back to this idea, like, of, like, sometimes I feel like, and I feel like, yes, we should, like, encouraging young people to read is great, and making like, things that they're interested in print available to them is, like, just the sine qua non. You can't really have a young reading community without that. But the other thing I think, especially, and it's directed, I think, more towards boys than girls, is that there's this belief that boys engage in activities that prevent them from reading or become intellectual, and this is not new. Mm-hmm. You know, it's video games now, but before video games, it was comic books. It still kind of is. You'll hear people say, oh, you know, they only read Magna, or they only read graphic novels, and that's not real literature. And it's reading, and some graphic novels are amazingly well written. And before comic books, it was, you know, pool halls. Mm-hmm. And before then, it was dance halls. And before that, you know, you go far enough back, you can, you know, worry about the young men in England going bowling in the 14th century, because, and they're not practicing archery and learning how to read Latin so they can give orders, and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Waltzing in the Middle Ages to...
Oh, yeah, how scandal, you know?
What a shock.
Mm. Yeah, I make it a point not to be the cool teacher. as much as I can, because there's nothing less cool than trying to be the cool teacher. And you know, I had some kid saw these stickers or something, and he's like, "How come we don't get stickers?" And of course he didn't understand this, but I enjoyed saying this. I'm like, I'm more into intrinsic motivation than extrinsic motivation. Like,
yeah,
I want you to do, you know, because you know, in teaching how to play an instrument, you know, I'll have a kid once in a while be like, "Well, what do we get for doing this?" I'm like, "You get the enjoyment of being able to play this instrument."
Right.
You know, it's because, you know, if it's just you're getting a reward for doing that, then it's, you know, that's, yeah, maybe I can get you to play for the year. But so I try to do things where it's, you know, it's the whole like teach a man to fish thing. It's like, if you learn how to do something, that's the greatest gift you can get, because then you can kind of go out into the world and enjoy it. And, you know, it's, I think, you know, it, a lot of it, I think, is on parents to set an environment in their house where they have access to these things. I think access is probably the most important thing, rather than saying anything else, because almost every book blogger that I've met, it's, my dad was a huge science fiction fan, or my mom, you know, it was there, and I eventually found it, and I went through it. Or, if, you know, even kids that are into music. My dad has all the Beatles albums, and I eventually found them. It wasn't someone sat down, like, because I can't, as a teacher, go, like, "You guys are going to listen to the Beatles, and you're going to love them." No, because that'll be the surest way to turn them off to it.
I never like teaching a book that I really love. Like, when I teach the Aeneid, it's with my heart in my mouth, because I love that book. And I want the students to love the book, but sometimes they don't, or they don't love it enough, or they don't love it in the right way. So, but you know, that's my problem. It's not their problem. I mean, they have the right not to love the Aeneid.
Of course.
But the temptation to impose my opinion on them is powerful. Mm-hmm. Especially when I'm sure I'm right. 2,000 years tell me I'm right.
Yeah. Well, we're kind of running out of time here, so if you have any final thoughts, that would be great. And if not, if you guys want to maybe say again your the books that you have available, maybe what you have coming up. So, Blake, why don't you tell us what's what you have going on?
Let's see. So, Spellwright came out in the U.S. Last March, and you can learn more about it at my website, blakecharlton.com. Blake as in the crazy poet. Charlton as in the crazy actor, Charlton Heston. Spellbound, the sequel, I just met with, here at World Fantasy, I just met with my editor to hash out some changes, and so far the feedback's been great. He said it was 2 or 3 times better than the first book, so that's exciting. He might have just been trying to motivate me to turn the edits around before the end of next month, so it comes out, and it's looking, we're hoping to get it out in the summer, but production at the end of the year is difficult.
Things shut down.
Yeah, and so I'll be, the next couple days are going to be pretty crazy for me. Hopefully it'll come out this summer, but it might be pushed back to fall if the chips don't fall well. So.
Okay.
It's out in Kindle and iBook. Yeah. I would have you sign my copy, except it's on my iPhone.
No, I'll sign your iPhone. I signed my first Kindle today.
Oh,
the other day. It was the coolest thing ever.
Awesome. Okay.
And James, what do you have coming out?
Let's see. Out this summer was my story, The Singing Spear in Swords and Dark Magic, the Strawn and Anders edited anthology. Mm-hmm. Great table of contents there. I'm not speaking about my name, but like Michael Moorcock and Glenn Cook and all these cool guys. Out this, actually it should be out already, but it's my fault that it's not The Wolf Age. It's the third of my Morlock Ambrosius novels. The first one, The Blood of Ambrose, is nominated for the World Fantasy Award. Mm. And
fingers crossed.
Yeah, you guys know better than I how it will come out. Yeah, so that's what I had going up. Wolf Age coming out this month.
Right, and Lou Anders told me to really get you to talk about Wolf Age, because when you were on our podcast a couple months ago...
I know, I'm terrible at that stuff. In Wolf Age, all my novels are standalone, so even though this is the third novel, it's not a trilogy. You can't call it that.
Yeah.
It's just 3 standalone books.
Okay.
And the third book finds Morlock separated from everyone he's known, caught up in this city of werewolves. He's actually taken prisoner by the werewolves and put into a prison. So the first third is actually in Morlock in a high security werewolf prison. So it's a feel good book. then when he gets out, he's hooked up in this werewolf election in this city where they have a democracy which is based on honor, teammate. So the more T teammate you have, the more power you have. So not all, some people are more equal than others, to quote Animal Farm. So then he gets hooked up in the election, which he doesn't care about except that his friends are involved.
So I have a question for you. As a classics major, so my book features prominently creatures I call lycanthropes.
Oh, cool.
And so I was wondering how, you know, as a classics major, what made you choose werewolf over lycanthrope?
Well, because I also do Germanic languages. That's one thing. It strongly appeals to me. Plus, they're more sort of Germanic werewolves.
Gotcha.
They're more sort of a savage.
Northmen.
Yeah, that sort of thing. Although they live in a democracy, which you might think sounds Greek. But there's a lot of democracy in the northern peoples, too.
Huh.
The Althing is the oldest democratically elected parliament in Europe. That's in Iceland.
Huh.
They just celebrated their 1,000th year sometime in the 1990s.
Wow.
So anyway, so I'm into the northern thing, too.
Yeah. Very cool.
Great. Well, guys, thank you for joining me today, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Cool. And that's it. I hope you enjoyed that interview. Next week, our next interview that we have coming up is another one that I conducted at World Fantasy, and that's with Kay Kenyon, a Pyre author, amongst other publishers. So we might as well get on to the plugs. Patrick, why don't you go first? Why don't you do your plugs for this week?
Oh, gosh. I did a complete redesign of atfmb.com, hopefully making it easier for people to find stuff. And so there's tons of things over there. I've got a ton of new pictures I'm doing for Photo Tuesdays based on a bunch of hiking that I did with Karen Burnham and Curtis, her husband. She does Spiral Galaxy and SF Signal and all that kind of stuff. So watch for that in the next couple of weeks. Let's see what else. Got a great post over on SF Signal about short fiction. Doing the new TV gig over at Technorati, writing recaps, reviews of television stuff. I think that's it for now.
Cool. Well, congratulations on the Technorati gig. I know.
Thanks.
I congratulated you over Twitter, but I wanted to do it via voice as well. So that's definitely cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, for what I have going on is, again, you can get a lot of my music over at johnanilio.bandcamp.com. By the time this airs, November will be over, but you can still get the NaNoWriMo song as in addition to my Sci-Fi Songs album. I'm also planning on putting a holiday EP out, which I don't think will be out by the time this airs, but probably shortly after. That's about it with the music stuff.
Is it a follow-up to the Hall of Justice song thing?
Well, it's going to include that. I'm going to basically include the couple of holiday songs that I already have out. Yeah, and then so I'm going to put like the Millennium Falcon song and the Batman Smell song.
Gotcha.
I've got a brand new one, and I got two new ones actually. One that's actually an old one that's a new one, and then I might do a remix of the Millennium Falcon song like I did for the NaNoWriMo song. So it'll be like a 4 or 5 song EP with two old ones and two new ones. Just a little something for December for people.
Very cool.
And like I said, you could check out my my videos over at Wired, the Geek Dad blog. I'm going to be doing a couple of sort of nerdy Christmas songs, teaching you how to play those this month as well.
Do you feel rusty as a podcaster right now?
No, not really.
God, I feel rusty. I haven't done any podcasting this whole week, and I just, that's like weird.
Yeah, totally. Oh, and to finish up, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JohnAnilio.
Sorry, John.
Oh, that's fine. But that's about it for this week. So join us next week for the interview with Kay Kenyon. And then we will, you know, have a new batch of interviews coming. I have some really exciting guests booked, which I don't want to announce all of them because some of them are kind of big names that I don't want to announce until we've actually recorded them because I'm afraid that they'll fall through. But got some really exciting, interviews coming up. So should be good.
Awesome. Bye.
All right. Bye, everybody. See you next week. Novel in 30 days, and by December I'll type the end on the last page. I've got some music, I've got my shiny new laptop, and now I'll use it as I sit down at the coffee shop. But everybody thinks I'm crazy.
I've only got 50,000 words to go before the end of NaNoWriMo. I thought that it'd be easy, but it's not. Yeah, I've only got 50,000 words to go before the end of NaNoWriMo. I've got everything I need. I've got a trusty sidekick. I've got a strong protagonist. There's a central conflict, but a weak antagonist. I've got a cliche.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.